Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
Radio Free Kansas.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. There's speculation today the White House is considering hosting a climate summit during Obama's second term. An Oregon environmental group told The Guardian it has had encouraging discussions with White House staff on the issue. The speculation comes on the heels of EPA head Lisa Jackson's resignation in late December and a new report out yesterday by NOAA. The National Climatic Data Center says 2012 was the warmest year on record in the contiguous 48 states. The data also indicates extreme weather events such as flooding and droughts are becoming more common. FSRN's James Moore reports from KRUU-FM in Iowa, one of several Midwest states where temperatures were far above normal.
Last year was Iowa's warmest since 1931, the dawn of the Dust Bowl era. And as during the Dust Bowl, much of the Midwest experienced severe rain shortages. Here, the worst drought in 50 years killed trees in cities across the state, and corn yields are expected to be down for the fourth straight year. Low water levels on the Mississippi and other Midwest rivers are creating significant challenges for barges trying to move grain to the Gulf. Iowa State University climatologist Elwin Taylor, who has studied agricultural climates for decades, has cautioned farmers and river shippers to get used to more volatile weather. Taylor believes nighttime temperatures are the key climate threat for farm economies. According to research, when overnight temperatures rise 4 degrees Fahrenheit above normal, grain crop yields are reduced by 15 to 20%. In 2012, 19 states experienced their warmest years since data began being collected in 1895. James Moore, FSRN, Fairfield, Iowa.
A new legislative session begins today in Illinois, and LGBT rights supporters say they intend to reintroduce same-sex marriage legislation before day's end. Lawmakers were unable to garner enough support for the measure during the previous session, which ended yesterday. But before the turnover, the General Assembly was able to pass a law allowing undocumented immigrants to get state driver's licenses. Governor Pat Quinn has praised lawmakers for saving lives on Illinois roads by mandating driver training, eye tests, and insurance for some 250,000 immigrant motorists. But as FSRN's Jay Saper reports, there's concerns about what this will actually mean for undocumented drivers.
This bill, touted as a common-sense traffic safety measure, was met with passionate pushback. Opponents blasted it for condoning illegal entry and inviting fraud. There are also divisions within the ranks of immigration rights groups and nervous immigrants. Claudia Enriquez, an attorney with the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, opposed the legislation based on the experiences of immigrants in other states.
They signed up to get the driving privilege card, and then the next day, for example, ICE showed up on their doorstep.
Supporters say the Illinois law has built-in protections to keep this kind of situation from occurring. The new licenses will not serve as official identification for boarding planes, buying guns, or voting. Jay Saper, FSRN, Chicago.
A judge has struck down part of the New York Police Department's stop-and-frisk policy. Yesterday, for the first time, a federal court ordered the NYPD to halt certain practices within the controversial program. From New York, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo has more.
The part of the NYPD's Stop and Frisk program in question is called Operation Clean Halls. It aims to prevent trespassing in and around privately owned apartment buildings in high crime areas. landlords must enroll to take part. U.S. District Judge Shira Sheenlin ruled Tuesday to end the practice. She said in these trespassing cases, it's difficult to pinpoint the line where police encounters become unconstitutional. But, quote, such a line exists, and the NYPD has systematically crossed it. Udi Offer of the New York ACLU says police often arrested friends and family of tenants, and even some tenants themselves, who didn't have identification on them.
Meaning that in the vast majority of cases, there wasn't even suspicion of a crime. And that's a problem, and that's what has to stop.
Stop and frisks technically require suspicion of a crime, but only 12% of the 685,000 stops last year led to arrests. Offer called the judge's ruling a big step towards eventually ending the stop and frisk program. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, New York.
The flag of the United Kingdom, the Union Jack, is flying at Belfast City Hall today for the first time since lawmakers decided not to display it permanently. Intense protests have been ongoing since that decision, recalling historic tensions between loyalists and nationalists in Northern Ireland. FSRN's Gloria Comker reports from the UK.
The flag is being flown to mark the birthday of Kate Middleton, the Duchess of Cambridge. But the occasion has not quelled the anger of British loyalists in Northern Ireland. In Belfast, hundreds of demonstrators have been protesting daily since early December when the council decided to limit the number of days the Union flag flies at City Hall to 17 per year. The flag will be taken down again this evening. Further demonstrations are planned, including a rally outside the Irish Parliament in Dublin on Saturday. The protests, at times violent, have resulted in more than 1,000 arrests and dozens of police officers being injured. Gloria Kamkar, FSRN, Southampton.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Well, welcome to Radio Free Kansas tonight. We're going to do a little shuffle here, and since there's so many climate change deniers out there, haven't played Alex Smith's Radio EcoShock for quite some time. Here's his first show of the year. Now, it's going to run nonstop, 60 minutes. Then we'll play the complete free speech radio news in the second hour, and I'll read some local news. Enjoy, and thank you, Alex Smith. Alex Smith. It's called The Heat Is On.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to another attempt to save reality from a whirlpool of superstition, wishful thinking, and propaganda. You and I will work through the biggest change humanity has ever faced. But what is climate change and what is not? Can we hear the signal through the noise? Scientists know the world is warming, seas are rising, ice is melting, we can see that. The denial is all over. Economic realists know the era of never-ending growth powered by fossil fuels is also drawing to a close. Like any population in nature, we cannot grow forever. Those certainties reveal themselves in a slow grind and then again in sudden jolts. There are still a lot of guesses bound to be proved wrong. There is still room for doubt in the details. Here is just one small example. I have reported on the surge of jellyfish in many parts of the world, especially in the Mediterranean. Ocean specialists have suggested this could be the result of overfishing or ocean acidification caused by incessant dumping of carbon into the atmosphere. But now, a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences says, quote, recurrent jellyfish blooms are a consequence of global oscillations. One author is Kathy Lucas from the University of Southampton. Another is ocean expert Carlos Duarte, who I interviewed in our February 15th show of 2012. A careful investigation shows there has been no increase in jellyfish over the past 200 years. It's a boom and bust species. There was another jelly wave in the 1970s, but nobody paid much attention. Another myth bites the dust. Later in this program, we're going to tackle a great divide between some climate scientists and the flood engineers on the ground, the experts in the United States. I've covered the wild floods in Nashville in May 2010 when the Grand Ole Opry went underwater. There were more floods in Wisconsin and Minnesota that fall. And these heavily news-laden flood events, are they a sure sign of global warming? Maybe not, says Robert M. Hirsch, research hydrologist and a former associate director for water at the U.S. Geological Survey. Hirsch isn't a climate denier. He knows the world is warming and these floods are mostly human-caused, sure, but not from greenhouse gases, he says. It's a tricky problem which will work our brains hard as we talk with one of the prominent experts in American river systems and flooding. If the hydrological cycle is still one of the wild cards waiting to be seen, the promise of growing heat on this planet is as sure as the laws of physics. More carbon in the atmosphere traps heat energy that would otherwise have bounced back into space. We've known that for more than 100 years. In just a few minutes, I'm going to chat with one of the best environmental journalists, Mark Hertzgard. I've been waiting for this talk with him. While Mark was wrapped up in key articles for The Nation magazine and just recently in Newsweek, while his 7-year-old daughter waits in the room, Mark has to explain to us what we all have to explain to our children. The climate has already been disrupted and will change still more. Hertzgard's latest book is Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. I want to welcome our first full-time radio station to broadcast Radio EcoShock in Australia. 3CR has been one of those activist community stations pounding at the corridors of power and injustice since 1976, and that furthers my own vision for a global English language program as we witness and create the great change in climate, energy, agriculture, and our society, and we'll do it in order to survive the passing of industrial civilization. It's a strange synchronicity. I just wrote an Australian scientist asking for an interview, saying it seemed like the land down under was just getting a break from the weird, dangerous weather that struck that continent from 2009 onwards. Then, on the 5th of January, 2013, the brand new year, starting out in the Australian summer, I hear this from the Australian News Network.
Our southern states are sweltering through a heat wave tonight with little relief in sight. 3 homes have been destroyed in a bushfire near Fawcett in Tasmania on a day when Hobart hit a record 41 degrees. Melbourne's experiencing the worst conditions since Black Saturday in 2009, while Adelaide had its hottest day in 4 years, a high of 45.
Adelaide is expected to have a cool change over the weekend, but it depends how you interpret the word cool. We're going to hit temperatures 10 degrees lower, but that's still around the mid-30s. Unfortunately, from Monday, it's going to go right back up there at 40.
You heard that right. Parts of Australia hit 47 degrees C and more. That's over 117 degrees Fahrenheit. The average for the whole country was 39 degrees C, a sweltering 102 Fahrenheit. Here's what blows me away. The extreme heat was in the south of Australia, not in the tropical north where you might expect it. In the capital of South Australia, Adelaide, the thermometer went over 45 degrees. That's 113. Nobody goes outside air-conditioned spaces in that kind of heat. And then there's dear Tasmania, the coolish island pointing towards Antarctica. The Tasmanian capital of Hobart peaked out at 41.8 degrees C, the highest since record-keeping began 120 years ago. That's the kind of extreme we need to watch out for as this relentless warming develops during the next decade. The heat wave and lack of rainfall created ideal conditions for brush fires across southern Australia. Tasmania ignited into at least a dozen fires in a land known for its wet, cool forests. At least 100 homes burned and a town called Dunalley was destroyed, as we hear from ABC News Australia.
Tasmania has experienced its worst day of bushfires for at least 45 years. Catastrophic fire conditions sparked around 30 bushfires across the state. Many of them are still burning out of control. 80 properties have been destroyed and there are fears one person has been killed. 4 of the fires have been so dangerous that residents have been advised to leave their homes. The town of Dunalley on the Tasman Peninsula was the hardest hit. Our reporter Felicity Ogilvie has just arrived there this morning. She had to travel into the town by boat because the bushfires have cut off the roads to Hobart. Felicity, what are you seeing?
Well, David, where there used to be houses, I am looking at twisted corrugated iron and just blackened out bricks where there used to be houses and burnt out cars here. The bush has been burnt out completely down to the waterfront. In the part of the main street I'm looking at now, there is just one house still standing and the local fish shed. It looks like most other houses are gone. And further up the canal, we know that the primary school has been burnt out here in Denali. And on the way into Denali this morning, around the Primrose Sands area, we saw a house still alight as the embers from the bushfire from the night before took hold of that.
So are there people still around, or did they all leave?
Yes, when we arrived by boat this morning, actually quite a few people came down to see if this was a way out of Denali from there for them, because as we said before, the roads are cut off here. People are desperate. They thought maybe we'll bring food to them. And as I've spoken to people around town this morning, I've heard tales of survival. One young couple who tried to stay to the end to defend their house, but then had to jump into the canal, and they were hiding there as the fire passed overhead. And I met a man, Greg Mann, who hid under a jetty up to his chest in the water with his young daughter. And he said after the fire front passed over that he went out and helped put out spot fires here in Denali.
I played a bit of that clip to prepare us all for the probability that superheat will stimulate burning forests in many parts of the world, even where you don't expect it. Maybe close to your own home. And what will you do? The Tasmanian bush will regrow, but some global forests will never come back, converting over to grasslands to entirely new ecosystems. But Australia is not escaping this year from the signs that it is a country destroying its own living space by ramping up their coal mining and exports. It's a race to the fiery bottom, mates. No more coal.
Radio EcoShock.
Speaking of extremes, here is another wild storm the press in the Northern Hemisphere mostly missed. You've heard about Hurricane Sandy, but what about Super Typhoon Bopha? Not so much, I'll bet. All credit to CNN weatherman Tom Sater for picking up on another climate-powered breakthrough reported December 4th, 2012.
Super Typhoon Bopha has just made landfall in the southeastern Philippines. This is the first time a super typhoon has ever come ashore in that country. Tom Sater is in the World Weather Center with a look at just how dangerous this storm can be. And Tom, you were talking to me a little bit earlier, and you used the word catastrophic.
Right. Unfortunately, Ralitza, I wish I had a fairy tale story like Max to share with you, but catastrophic is exactly what we're looking at when it comes to Mindanao. Now, we've had typhoons all over in the Philippines. They have them, and they're quite strong. But if you look at this view from space, I mean, this is over 22,000 miles, over 35,000 kilometers away, and you can see it. It's the bottom of the screen. Really, so there are so many factors and facets to this storm that make this so unusual, and this is why this is a big concern right now. As we get in a little bit closer, Mindanao is the second largest island in the Philippines, but because it's extremely south, it's close to the equator. Systems just don't develop. First of all, this time of year in December, if you talk about Mindanao in the month of December, I mean, they have typhoons, but once every 10 years. But they've never had one of this size. They've never had a super typhoon move into Mindanao. They just don't develop close to the equator. In fact, there's only one other one that we know of in recorded history that developed closer to the equator. But this is a monster storm. So it is an area that they've never needed to build up the defenses on the shoreline. This is unprotected shoreline. One year ago, this month, the 16th and 17th of December, it was tropical storm, a small tropical storm. It moved inland almost the exact same path, eerily similar, to Bopha here, which the locals are calling Pablo. You may hear that. But what we're looking at is the amount of rainfall. 1,200 people lost their life with Washi as it moved in overnight, just hordes and torrents of water downstream, wiping out villages. This is what we call in meteorology as a midget typhoon. It's only 500 kilometers wide. Washi was another 100 kilometers larger, 600. But it's got a small, tight area of very strong winds. And that's what we're watching right now. Davao City, 1.5 million people. Butuan, about 60,000. It's not so much the winds, I think, that are going to knock out power to possibly a million. Look at the winds. 315 kilometers per hour. Ralitza, it's the rainfall. Typically for the month, they may pick up 117. This could drop 200, 250, maybe 300. They do not have a defense line. And one note to pass along to you. Just heard from officials, local officials, 3,400 people are stranded on piers. I don't understand. They did not get out in time, and the ferry service is cut off. They're stranded on piers with no protection. We'll be watching this one closely.
This time with Bopa, only hundreds died in the Philippines, not the thousands in the much smaller cyclone Washi, a.k.a. Sendong, in December 2011. I guess part of my point is there is a southern hemisphere, people. Big things happen in countries that don't have major international news services. The climate is going out of control far beyond London and New York. We need a system of monitors, blogs, news, and alerts to remind us a global problem is unfolding. There are so many untold stories in South America, Africa, Asia, and the Pacific, and so many ears who tune all that out. I'll wrap up this ramble with just one more story that caught my eye this week. Al Jazeera reports the Mexican drug gang called the Zetas Cartel is moving into coal mining. Reporter John Holman writes on January 4, 2013, on October 7, Mexican Marines swooped in on one of the most powerful men in organized crime. But as the Navy triumphantly announced the death of Heriberto Lascano, leader of the Zetas gang, there was puzzlement over where he had been found. Far from the Zetas strongholds and practically unprotected, he had been watching a baseball game in the small mining village of Progreso. Theories abounded as to what exactly Lascano had been doing in Progreso, a one-horse town in the wide-open spaces in the southern state of Cahuilla. Humberto Morera, ex-governor of Cahuilla, says that he has the answer, quote, Heriberto Lascano changed from being a killer, kidnapper, and drug dealer to something still more lucrative, mining coal. That's why he lived in the coal region in a little village called Progreso, end quote. Speaking to Al Jazeera, Morera says that the Zetas gang is fast discovering that illegal mining is an even more lucrative venture than drug running. They discover a mine, extract the coal, sell it at $30, pay the miners a miserable salary. It's more lucrative than selling drugs. And that ends my quote from reporter John Holman of Al Jazeera. The Mexican government has confirmed the drug gangs have infiltrated the coal mines in the state of Cahuilla. Why do I think that matters? It says everything about where we are going. Sure, there's already a criminal conspiracy to mine climate-damaging coal in the United States. In fact, two U.S. senators have just called for an investigation into the low rates given to big mining corporations on publicly owned lands, and that's in the Powder River Basin of eastern Montana and Wyoming. After a call by Western ranchers, the Reuters News Service investigated how Cloud Peak Energy Corp., Arch Coal, and Peabody Energy Group got such low royalties while making a fortune exporting that coal, not to the United States, but to Asia. Criminal charges are possible. Everybody with a brain knows it's just as criminal to blow the tops off the Appalachian Mountains to get the coal. Plus, the coal lobby has their dirty hands in the federal government in Washington for a generation or two. They make sure the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't clear up the air too much. Millions have died breathing dirty coal pollution around the world, and no president seems able to stop it. The Zeta gang could never kill so many or make so many billions of dollars doing it. But I think organized crime is the future of coal. As more people around the world realize they can't cope with extreme climate change, they will demand an end to coal. We can't rebuild fast enough from major climate damage. We can't find the money or the will. We can't stand the floods or the heat waves and the droughts. Months of hot cities well over 35 degrees C in the hundreds Fahrenheit will motivate a lot of people. Eventually, many of us can't survive in a 4-degree warmer world. We'll call for an end to coal. When that social tipping point comes, there might be a war on coal, just like the failed wars on terrorism or drugs. Where governments try to suppress the last killing mines, organized crime will fill the need. Coal will come out of the black market, literally the underground economy. It won't surprise me if a minor war is fought in a coming decade not to get the coal, but to stop it from reaching the damaged atmosphere. And how will we survive then? Mark Hertzgard is here to tell us. I'm Alex Smith. You are listening to Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. First, climate change was coming. Now it's here in storms, rising seas, and much more. Our guest, Mark Hertzgaard, first came to my attention with his late 1990s book, Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. That came after a quest of many years to find our impact on the natural world. Since then, I've read Mark's leading-edge work in Vanity Fair, Newsweek, The New Yorker, and in his current post as environmental reporter for The Nation magazine. Mark Hertzgaard, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
I appreciate you finding the time. You've been extra busy lately, published not just in The Nation, but also your December 10th article in Newsweek. That's a good place to jump in. What has climate change got to do with pasta?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to say this for my beloved 7-year-old daughter. The piece that ran in Newsweek that you're referring to is called The End of Pasta because of what climate change threatens to do to wheat. And, of course, pasta is made from wheat. And when I was describing this story one evening to a fellow journalist who was over visiting and giving him the 30-second elevator pitch for it, I neglected to notice that my 7-year-old was off in the corner there, and turned out that she was listening more closely than I thought, and she said, "No, Dad, you can't have the end of pasta. After all, I am Italian," and because she's Italian-American. And so I told her that, well, that's why I wrote this article, so that we can try to prevent the end of pasta, because, you know, there is still an awful lot that we can do if we get started quickly and act very, very urgently. There's a lot we can do, not only to protect wheat and therefore pasta for mac and cheese loving little kids all over America and around the world for that matter, but also things that we can do to prepare our communities for the amount of climate change that is now unstoppable and to prevent that amount of climate change from being unsurvivable. There is, unfortunately, an awful lot of inertia in the climate system that we cannot prevent. There are going to be increasing difficulties in the years ahead, but we need to work very rapidly now to keep those difficulties relatively manageable.
Well, you know, I've talked with Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute, and he's warning for every 1 degree rise in temperature, we'd expect about a 10% drop in world grain production. And now it seems like everybody from Kevin Anderson to the World Bank is warning a 4 degree rise is maybe the new normal by 2050. So doesn't that lead to some horrible math for a world expecting to feed 9 billion people?
It does if we let that 4 degrees happen. So we simply can't do that. If we allow 4 degrees centigrade of temperature rise in this century, that will basically create a situation where civilization as we know it will not survive. Not least because when you have a 4 degree C temperature rise, some of the impacts that would unleash, such as melting vast stores of methane that are underneath the tundra in Russia and Upper Canada, that would create a situation where global warming becomes, in effect, irreversible. And so we simply can't allow that to happen, it seems to me. I mean, again, I say this as the father of a 7-year-old, and it really, it does change your perspective on that. You were kind enough to mention Earth Odyssey. When I wrote Earth Odyssey in the 90s, I wasn't a dad. And, in fact, in my new book, Hot, I talk about how, in the very first paragraph, about when I was traveling around the world in the 90s, like most international journalists, I've seen a lot of terrible things happen to kill children, but they were always other people's children. And when it's your kid, there is something different that kicks in. And so that was what led me to write the book Hot, because my daughter had just been born when I was on assignment for Vanity Fair right after Hurricane Katrina, and went to London and learned from the chief science advisor of the British government, Sir David King, that we were now, as a planet, already locked into a significant amount of climate change over the next 50 years, even if we act very quickly. And so the challenge, Alex, really is to keep that 4 degrees C temperature rise from happening. We've already had 1 degree C from the amount of greenhouse gases that are already up there. We've desperately got to keep that to the minimum amount possible.
Well, let's get specific. What's happening with wheat, say, in the United States?
Yes, for this story for Newsweek, I went out to North Dakota, which who knew, but North Dakota is where some of the best pasta in the world begins. They happen to have just the right, or have had, I should say, just the right set of climatic conditions to grow some of the best durum wheat in the world, which, just parenthetically, most wheat in the world is used to make bread, but durum wheat is what you use to make pasta. And already in the last 30 to 40 years, the pasta wheat growing area in North Dakota has been dramatically shifted by climate change. You used to be able to grow durum throughout the state of North Dakota, and over the last 30 years, that has shifted. The growing zone has shifted west. And so the eastern half of North Dakota, almost no durum is grown now. Now it's grown in the western half and even into eastern Montana and the neighboring region in Canada. Ironically, one of the things that that means is that the durum zone, by climate change, has pushed the durum growing zone into the very area of North Dakota, Montana, Canada, where there is now one of the biggest oil booms in recent history underway, the Bakken oil boom out there. And so that was a remarkable thing for me to see as a reporter, to go out and talk to the durum wheat producers out there and to see their land now being taken over by oil drilling and natural gas drilling, which, of course, is only going to make climate change worse. So you see both sides of the problem there. You know, it's not just in North Dakota. We've already seen over the last 50 years, the temperature rise of the last 50 years has already reduced globally, has reduced wheat production by about 5.5% from what it would otherwise have been. So, you know, these impacts are happening now. They are projected to get much worse unless we act very, very rapidly to get off of fossil fuels and onto the clean, green economy of the 21st century.
Well, with this drought and with floods in other parts of the world like Great Britain, we're already seeing rising food prices, but we saw a more violent and immediate threat in Hurricane Sandy. Congress almost failed to pass legislation to help rebuild New York and New Jersey after the storm. What do you make of that?
Well, during the so-called fiscal cliff negotiations, the House of Representatives, the Republican leadership there, declined to take up that bill to provide even relief to the New York, New Jersey area. They got such a political backlash, including from fellow Republicans like Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey, that now they've backtracked and the Republican leadership will allow a vote. But I think the larger point here is that, unfortunately, the United States is still very, very far behind the rest of the world in its, what I like to call, the social capital response. You know, as we prepare for climate change, lots of the interest and focus is on technical questions and physical infrastructure. Can we build a seawall around New York City to protect it against sea level rise and storms? And that's all important. But really, the most important is the question of social capital. What kind of a society do you have? Do you have a society that believes in science, that values science, that believes in government, that is willing to be taxed in order to pay for public services? And when I was writing my book, Hot, about how to deal with the next 50 years of climate change, I went and spent quite a bit of time in the Netherlands, which, of course, has been dealing with these issues for many, many years because they're such a low-lying coastal country. And one of the greatest advantages that the Dutch have is that they do have that kind of social capital. They believe in science. They believe in government. They believe in collective action. They are willing to pay taxes, and they trust their government to invest those taxes properly to defend the nation against storms and flooding and so forth. That is what is really lacking in the United States, and nowhere more than in the Republican Party, which, very unfortunately from a climate perspective, the Republican Party continues to be able, inside of Capitol Hill, to block most important initiatives here. And unfortunately, we saw that in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy.
Well, yeah, but the Republicans paid for it in the recent elections with the Latino vote. What did you find out about people of color and climate?
Yeah, that was such a remarkable development. I wrote about that in The Nation. I think it's one of the real unsung positive developments out of 2012. And you're right. I think that even before that happened, that Hurricane Sandy had a real impact on the presidential race, despite Barack Obama's shameful silence on the issue for most of the campaign. But then Mother Nature itself spoke up and said, okay, you know, climate change is here and it's real. But aside from the president's silence, I think he still benefited because as you mentioned, Latinos and other groups, but especially Latinos, voted for Obama at almost a 75-25% preference over Mitt Romney. And part of that, of course, was Romney making very insensitive remarks about immigration. For example, during the Republican primaries, he urged that Hispanics self-deport to solve the immigration issue. But it was also a matter of the environment. And it's oftentimes misunderstood. People tend to think of the environment and climate change in particular as an issue that that's those Prius-driving, upper-middle-class, white environmentalists. Well, in fact, the data shows, and especially here in California where I live, that Latinos and almost as much African-Americans, Asian-Americans, and especially youth of all races, they care about climate change very, very much. In fact, there's an enormous gap on the climate issue for Latinos. They support action on this, including government action. It's not just that they believe that climate change is real. They want the government to do something about it by astonishing margins, 20% to 80%. Only 20% of Latinos are not concerned about this. And in the 2012 election, Latinos and youth in particular and these other groups that I mentioned, they voted in large numbers. And so this is a very encouraging thing going forward if, and this is a big if the mainstream environmental movement can recognize this fact and respond accordingly. Because traditionally and frankly for too long, the U.S. environmental movement has been dominated by very well-meaning but white upper-middle-class people who are older and who see issues of environmental justice as something that, it's nice and they should do it and it's the right thing to do. And what they really need to understand is that, no, this is the future of the environmental movement. You're not doing these people any favors. They're the ones who are going to be doing a favor for you, because if environmentalists want to win in the United States, they need to put Latinos and blacks and Asian Americans at the front of the movement and to find ways to deal with those issues, not just as one political consultant says, you can't just talk about butterflies. You've got to talk about jobs, because it's Latinos and African Americans and others. They're the ones who generally are living closest to the coal-fired power plants, the oil refineries, and all the other pollutants that are killing them on a daily basis, not just the long-term dangers of climate change.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with one of the premier environmental journalists of the English language, author and commentator Mark Hertzgard. His latest book is Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Mark, you have said we have to stop climate change, but we also have to live through it. How are we going to do that? What strategies would you offer our listeners to adapt to the big changes that are coming?
Well, that's a tough one, Alex. That's the whole focus of that book, Hot, so it's hard to crystallize it into a few words, but I'll say a few things. First, that book is 80% about solutions. We know what the problem is now, so let's really get focused on the solutions. The smartest thing I heard, and this came from leaders all over the world, not just in the Netherlands, but also here in the United States, there are some impressive people, and in Britain, those are the real leaders on this, that our goal has to be to avoid the unmanageable and manage the unavoidable. So there's two parts to coping with climate change now. On the one hand, we have absolutely got to, as we discussed earlier in this broadcast, keep the temperature rise at a minimum. We have to avoid unmanageable amounts of temperature rise. We cannot survive a 4°C temperature rise on this planet. So we've got to do everything we can to get off of fossil fuels and halt deforestation and change our agricultural system. And by the way, there's a lot of very good things happening there. Don't believe this nonsense that, we can't do it. And for that, I refer listeners to what's going on in Germany. And there's a new book about the, as they call it in German, the Energiewende, which is the energy turn, the big turn that Germany is making. They are leaving behind fossil fuels. And by 2030, all of their electricity will be coming from non-carbon sources. And that, by the way, comes from the third biggest economy in the world's leading export nation, the economic superpower of Europe. The Germans have decided to do that. And by the way, they're being led by a center-right political party now. So this is not a left-right political issue. So that's the first thing. But then, getting to the core of your question, the other challenge is we must manage the unavoidable. even if we keep temperature rise to 1 or 2 degrees Celsius, there's going to be a lot of impacts. Look at the impacts we're already seeing today with only 1 degree of rise. Hurricane Sandy, the terrible floods in Pakistan a year and a half ago that put 14 million people out of their homes. 14 million people in one of the most conflict-prone and nuclear-trigger-happy regions of the world. So we've got to prepare for that. And the ways to do that are many, but it will take money, and it takes social organization. We've got to manage the unavoidable. And there are things that you can do, even in one of the happiest and most uplifting parts of Hot, told the story of how some of the poorest people in the world, farmers in Western Africa, are already adapting to climate change. Even though they don't know that term, they're adapting to climate change by planting more trees and bushes in their fields, and that is increasing their productivity, agricultural productivity, because when you plant trees and bushes, it means that your fields are relatively cooler because of the shade, and it means that your soil is able to absorb what little rain they get there instead of the rain flashing off. So there's many things you can do. The Dutch, of course, are the world leaders in this. They have been building sea defenses and river dikes, but also changing how they govern themselves. And one example that I tell in the book Hot was how they had decided, okay, we're going to be getting more downpours, but also more drought. So what are we going to do? Well, they decided that they would take this area that was now a huge field. I went out to look at it, and they were going to turn it into a lake. And so this lake, when the River Rhine was overflowing, the flooding would be contained by diverting that water into this field and turning it into a lake, and then that water would then be available for drinking and so forth in the event of drought. And I said to the government official who's leading me around, I said, well, that all sounds very well, but look, here's all these farmers who have this land. What about them? And he said, oh, don't worry. They will be bought out. We'll give them a fair price for their land, and they'll be fine. And I said, well, what if they don't want to be bought out? And he looked at me as if that were a very American question, which it was. And he said, we have discussed this issue repeatedly over 4 years, from the local level to the regional level to the national level and back down again. It has been decided that this is what we need to do. And at the end of the day, you cannot allow two or three people to get in the way of what is good for everyone. And that, Alex, is what I mean about social capital. That ability for a society to realize that, no, we have to do what's best for all of us, that collective action is going to be necessary in these cases, and a transparency, a democratic process, to be sure, but in the end, you act. And contrast that to other places I went for this book, like in Louisiana and Florida, which are, of course, prime targets for hurricanes, and where that sort of action is literally inconceivable because of the sacred nature of private property in those political and cultural contexts. You know, in Louisiana, they did not even have a building code. They did not have a statewide building code prior to Hurricane Katrina. And why not? Well, as was explained to me, because that would be socialism. You're talking about government planning, that's socialism. Well, of course, it's nothing of the sort, but that's the kind of difference that is going to be very problematic, frankly, for Florida and a lot of the American South that still holds to those ideas about the individual and government is always bad. Although, isn't it funny that, when you get hit, then suddenly the opponents of big government suddenly change their minds. You saw this with Representative Peter King of New York lambasting the Republican leadership for ignoring and failing to take a vote right after the fiscal cliff stuff to give Hurricane Sandy relief. You know, when it's their people that are getting hurt, oh, then it's unconscionable that big government doesn't step in. When it's other people, they're on their own. You know, we got that big deficit we got to worry about. So that kind of attitude is something that is very troublesome, I think, for the United States. And so for listeners, I would say that, you know, you want to make sure that your community is a community that works together, where people are closely knit and checking in on one another, and that you've got a government that works and that is willing and able to tax itself responsibly, prudently, and deliver on those taxes. But that's what we're going to need, is a lot more of that kind of effort going forward.
Well, Mark Hertzgard, where can people find out more about this book and about your ongoing writing?
Very simple. I have a website, markhertzgard.com, and I'll just remind folks it's a double A, as my Norwegian ancestors would be proud to say. And people who are interested, you know, you can buy hot there and any other place. But I'd also just put in a quick plug as well for a group that I'm trying to start with some others called Climate Parents. And we're trying to organize parents and, for that matter, grandparents to finally speak out and get active on climate change. We find it just baffling that given the stakes for what all of us hold most dear, which is our children, and, you know, my daughter Kiara is why I wrote Hot. It's astonishing to us that parents have been so quiet for so long about climate change, and we want to change that. And if you'd like to join us, please go to climateparents.org and let us know.
Well, you've hit me. I'm a parent, and I really care about what happens to my kids, and I'm hoping that'll be a wave that spreads around the world. We have been lucky to spend some time with one of the power minds on climate change, investigative green journalist Mark Hertzgard. You can read his columns in The Nation magazine and in many others. Mark's latest book is Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Find his website at markhertzgard.com, and I'll put links to this interview in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Mark, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Are there more floods? Is it climate change? Our guest is Robert M. Hirsch, a well-known research hydrologist and high-ranking water expert for the United States Geological Survey. Dr. Hirsch, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Robert, there is more concern about flooding, and I was surprised to find there's another whole community dealing with the year-to-year reality of floods in the United States. Most of my guests are climate scientists, but how would you characterize the differences between the climate community and maybe the civil engineers and flood planners on the ground?
Well, in the hydrologic community, civil engineers, flood planners, et cetera, we're trying to take a look at the question of flood hazards in general, which is really a combination of things that may be going on with the climate, things that are going on in the particular watersheds, and what's happening along the floodplains. And I want to just point out right off the bat that I'm not at all talking about coastal floods. Those are a very different kind of phenomena having to do with oceanic storms and sea level. I'm really talking here about river floods. And what we see is that if we look at watersheds where the effect of human activity in the watershed is relatively minimal, that is to say, no large amounts of urbanization, no dams of any substantial size, that by and large, we don't see much of a change in the size of the floods that we get really over the last century or so. We see some areas of decrease and some small areas of increase, but taken as a whole, we don't see a great deal of change.
All right. Well, we're going to take some time to develop that idea further. One of the terms you use, which few of us know, is stationarity. What does it mean, and why is it important for water management or climate?
Right. Stationarity is a statistician's term that has to do with the idea that there's a probability distribution of certain kinds of events, in this case, a probability distribution of floods. And the assumption of stationarity is really the assumption that the floods that we get in any given year come from the same distribution that they did in the past, that the mean value, the standard deviation, et cetera, haven't been changing over time. And all of the methodologies that civil engineers and others use to design for things to protect people against flooding, whether it's laying out flood zoning areas, to build flood walls, to design dams, spillways, et cetera, are really all based on this assumption of stationarity. And it's very important that we look at the question of, do the data suggest that we're departing from that assumption of stationarity, or are we not at this point?
Right, because if we were departing from it, that might be a signal of climate change. Is that what we're getting?
That's right. But in a lot of cases, it could also be a signal of things that are happening within the watershed, for example, urbanization and land drainage and other things that people do on the landscape. So there's a multitude of possible reasons for non-stationarity, climate change being just one of them.
All right. Well, I've been in correspondence with Dr. Jeff Bonin at the National Atmosphere and Ocean Administration. He, like you, is very cautious about assigning a big role for climate change in the remarkable floods we've seen in the past 3 years or so. I'm thinking of the Mississippi floods in the spring of 2011. It was one of the worst recorded in the past century. Or the strange 2010 flooding of Nashville. Do you think these extreme floods are signs of climate change, or is it something else?
I think any given event can never be demonstrated to be a result of climate change. You have to really look at a preponderance of data and seeing over a large number of locations and over a large period of time that we're seeing a change in this probability distribution of floods. And so a few particularly unusual incidents really don't give a clear demonstration of that. The other thing I would point to is that when we look at very long records, and when I say that, I'm talking about 100 years, 120 years, which are about as long as any of our gauge records go, there are a number of places in the country where we see very long-term variability. And I'll use the Upper Mississippi River Basin as an example. It also applies to places like the Red River of the North in North Dakota and Minnesota. And that is that during the late 19th century, some of these areas had extremely large floods. Then during much of the 20th century, up until the last two or three decades of the 20th century, the floods were much, much smaller by and large. And then they've come back to, we're seeing sort of a clustering of from fairly large events. And when we look at it in that perspective, seeing that we had high and then we had low and then we had high flooding events, it really brings into question the idea that this could be greenhouse driven, because clearly the greenhouse gas increase is a fairly recent phenomenon, mostly in the last 4 or 5 decades. So that it brings up the idea that there are some very long-term, what I call quasi-periodic oscillations in the climate system. People have heard of El Nino and Atlantic Oscillation and some of these things, which are examples of quasi-periodic oscillations causing either wetter conditions or drier conditions or warmer or cooler, and they last for some particular period of time. But I think it's also recognized that some of these kinds of oscillations can last for decades or even centuries. And maybe the classic of all of these oscillations is the ice ages, which came and went over periods of hundreds of thousands of years, obviously with no influence of man causing them to come or go. So I think we have to be kind of recognize that there are some major oscillations that occur that can be driving floods, as well as the possibility that climate change could be driving changes in flooding.
All right. Well, why don't you tell us just a bit more about some of the other human factors that can lead to extreme floods that aren't climate related?
Absolutely. The most well-known and well-understood of these phenomena is in urbanization and the building of streets, sidewalks, rooftops that drain to those streets and sidewalks, and all these things that make much of the land surface relatively impervious, and that the rain that falls on it runs off very, very quickly and creates much larger floods. And this is a phenomenon that's been well known and well documented for many decades and can result in doubling or even quadrupling or even greater increases in the size of floods that one sees in these kinds of watersheds. And in many cases, communities, neighborhoods that say were located along beside a stream that may have been relatively safe from flooding in the past now become very, very susceptible to flooding because of these changes in the drainage system, in the pavement, et cetera, that lies upstream. So this is a very, very big cause of increased flooding. There's another cause which has to do with constraining the river channel between levees or flood walls, which is often used to protect communities in the floodplain. This can have the effect of causing the flood to move more quickly down a river and therefore sort of concentrate itself in areas that are located more downstream. The floodplain of a river, that is to say the flat area typically on both banks of a river, is a very important sort of natural storage device that will naturally attenuate the size of floods. If we don't allow that floodplain to operate and store the water and also allow some of that water to infiltrate into the ground, it can increase the probability of flooding or the size of flooding that occurs downstream. So those are two of the things that are big factors. Other factors that are a little harder to pin down in terms of what their impacts are things like wetland drainage and other forms of drainage like agricultural tile drainage, which have an effect that's somewhat like that of paving over the land surface because it creates a more rapid and direct conduit for the water as it comes down in precipitation to ultimately reach the stream. So this can be another factor, but it's a little harder to identify and estimate how large those consequences are.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the award-winning and much-published water expert, Dr. Robert M. Hirsch. He's with the United States Geological Survey. Well, I'm sure, Dr. Hirsch, one of the questions my listeners are asking themselves is, are we seeing more flooding in America than in the past? Can we answer that question?
First of all, I think it's very important that people recognize the distinction between flooding as a sort of a physical phenomena as measured by the amount of water moving down a river versus measuring the damages associated with floods in terms of property losses or even loss of life. Property losses from flooding have definitely gone up in recent decades and seem to be continuing to go up. But a lot of this is associated with more and more people living in harm's way along the floodplains of our nation's rivers. Strictly as a phenomena of how much water comes downstream, we can say a couple of things. If we look at most of the western United States, west of the 100th meridian, which would be a line, a north-south line that would run through about Bismarck, North Dakota, let's say, all the way down to Texas. To the west of that, by and large, we're seeing actually that floods are getting smaller over the last decade. That doesn't mean in every location they are, but in quite a number of them are, particularly in the southwest. And this actually may be related to climate change, and it means because of having smaller snowpacks in the mountains, which in those snowpacks are really a potential source of flooding when they get hit with a warm rainfall event, let's say. Looking more to the eastern part of the United States, there's a couple of areas that seem to be showing some increases. One of them is an area that runs from, let's say, Fargo, North Dakota, on down into parts of Iowa and the upper Midwest that certainly have had a cluster of very large floods in the last, say, since the 1970s and up pretty much to the present. But I should also add that that's an area that saw very large floods in the late 19th century, so it kind of confounds the story. One other area is New England, kind of running from the Catskills outside of New York City and on up through New England, does seem to be showing some increase in the frequency and magnitude of large floods. But for the rest of the eastern part of the country, looking at many stream gauges that we have that have very long records, it's really kind of a random scattershot of some that show increases, some that show decreases, and we would say that it's really nothing more than you would expect by chance alone. So that's kind of the story that we see. We think it's important that it continue to be monitored and continue to be checked because we think it's important to understand if those changes are afoot and to be able to develop an ability to predict how they'll change so people can adjust to the kind of flooding that they may face in the future as climate changes.
Well, should cities be upgrading their stormwater systems or their dikes or other flood defenses?
In general, I think one of the things we've learned in recent years is that there's a lot of uncertainty about the size of floods that one can expect in any given area. And that uncertainty comes because you can go through long periods of relatively small floods and think you don't need to build that infrastructure very large and then encounter a period of large floods. So adding more of a safety factor, I think, can often be important. But I don't think we have the science in hand at this point to tell people what those design changes need to be. I think there are some other reasons to look at urban drainage design, whether it's our rooftops or our lawns or our streets or our sidewalks. And that really has to do with water quality, and that the runoff from those areas in through our storm sewers and eventually into our rivers can be a source of considerable pollution. And in areas like resolving problems of Chesapeake Bay's water quality or Lake Champlain or Long Island Sound and a whole variety of places, that changing our design of our urban infrastructure so that it captures more of the water and stores it and really keeps it on the landscape rather than letting it run quickly to the rivers has a lot of merit just because of the things that it will do to help our water quality.
Could you talk to us just a bit more about some of the work that you have done trying to sort out what is unusual weather and what could be climate disruption?
My focus is on the flood phenomena itself, as opposed to trying to look at the things that are happening in the atmosphere that create it. I think that's a very important job, to look at what's going on in the atmosphere, but I think it's also important to sort of look at the floods themselves. And we did a little study that we published a couple of years ago, my colleagues and I at the USGS, where we took these very long stream flow records and we asked a very simple question: are the size of the floods that we see at these locations, and there were about 200 of these sites spread all over the country with very long records, and we said, does there seem to be some correlation between the size of the floods and the amount of greenhouse gases in the global atmosphere? And that by looking at the collection of these many sites and the potential relationship, we hoped to be able to see if there was a connection between the two. It's a little bit like medical people doing epidemiological studies. They're not so much focused on what happened to this one person and why did they get sick, but rather to look at an environmental factor. In the case of epidemiology, it might be, say, smoking and the incidence of disease. We're looking at an environmental factor, which is greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and a consequence, which is flooding. And in a general way, we found really no strong association at a national level. And when we looked regionally, the only place we saw a strong association was in the Southwest, where it was a negative relationship. That is to say, the more greenhouse gases, the smaller the floods. So that's what we did, and we have some more studies being planned to look at the data in a variety of other ways to see if we can, the way I like to call it, is see if we can tease out the signal. Because I think ultimately climate change will have some effect, but it's not even entirely clear what that effect might be, what even the direction of the effect might be, and it might be quite different in different parts of the country.
Well, one thing I've noticed about your work, you emphasize the unique properties of each watershed. Do you have a favorite river you like to visit and study?
I have several. I'm fascinated by the Red River of the North, North Dakota and Minnesota, because it's undergone such an enormous change in the flooding phenomena over the last few decades. And there's a lot of competing arguments about why that might be taking place, including the nature of the farming and the fact that the landscape is still rebounding somewhat from the retreat of the glaciers. It's one of the flattest places on the face of the earth, and it's very hard for the water to get out of there. So that's a favorite. Of late, I've been working quite a bit on things in the Susquehanna River, draining large parts of Pennsylvania and some of New York into Chesapeake Bay, and looking at questions of flooding and stream flow in general, and how that relates to the quality of water and the pollution that's going into Chesapeake Bay, and the efforts to try to turn that around. So those are just a couple of favorites that I'm interested in. And the kind of work that I do relies very heavily on very, very long-term, very consistently collected records of stream flow that the USGS has collected now for over 120 years at locations all across the country. And these data are really invaluable at describing environmental conditions all across the country.
Well, when it comes to climate, I wish we had another 100 or 200 years to collect the records, but it looks like things are moving too fast for that. I'm wondering, is there something that I've missed or anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Yeah, one of the things, and it's interesting, that some people hear my message and come to the conclusion that I'm a, let's say, a climate change denier. And I think it's important to try to be more clear about this particular point of view, and I'm not the only one that holds this particular point of view. I'm not at all a climate change denier. I believe that there's a lot of things that we can see and a lot of things that the climate models are seem to be doing a reasonably good job of predicting about changes. And mostly those are about changes in temperature, and particularly about changes in temperature in high latitudes, say near the North or North Pole or places like Alaska or Northern Canada. But what I'm skeptical about is whether our understanding of the climate system is good enough to understand how these changes in greenhouse gases affect the water cycle and affect particularly how they affect storms. And when I look at the output of the climate models and how they would describe things that have already happened over, say, the last 100 years, because the models can be run in what we call hindcast mode, in other words, looking at the actual changes in greenhouse gases that have taken place and then simulating what kind of climate changes we might see over the preceding century. The models can do a pretty good job with temperature in general, but they don't seem to do a good job of describing things relating to water. And I don't mean that to just be a put down on the climate scientists. This is a very, very difficult job. And the point I'm trying to make is we probably don't have in hand today in the scientific community the predictive tools to describe what will happen to water as a consequence of climate change, even though we do have tools to describe a number of other things about our environment.
Well, you're not the first scientist to tell me about that uncertainty in the water cycle, and obviously we just need to learn a lot more, and we don't want to spend a lot of money dealing with problems that have to do with other things that humans are doing, as you've brought out, you know, whether it's building in the floodplains and so on. So we want to make sure that we're dealing with the actual changes of climate change, and that's one of the reasons why I called you today. Well, we've been talking with Robert M. Hirsch, a career water expert recommended by other experts. Dr. Hirsch, thank you for spending time with Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find links for this program at our show blog. That's at ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening, and tune in next week as Radio EcoShock takes on the world.
And he does do radio. Alex Smith is so cool. He is so cool. He really is. I mean, it puts out great shows. I mean, he takes off a couple months every year to do this, but these are really professionally well-done shows, and he does seek to get cutting-edge stuff from scientists about the ecology, the environment, climate change. I've got most of my leads from him. I hope you listen to him, take notes. You know, he's got his own, one of the largest, actually the largest, probably on the in the world, website with all these free MP3s archived of his shows in coming out of Canada. And I'm guilty. I get them and use them, but unfortunately, I don't get to use every one of them. So you really ought to go and explore. Over the years, I've broadcast, I don't know, gobs and gobs of them. But there's more than that. I'm just touching the tip of the iceberg, the melting iceberg, so to say, of what Alex Smith has put out. So check it out at Radio EcoShock, and you will not regret it. I've been following, while listening to Alex's show, been following this incredible commentary going back and forth at the Wichita Eagles website. The article is written by Dion Leffler, who's a prominent Kansas journalist in Kansas here at the Wichita Eagles especially. Its headline, Voter ID Law Criticized at Wichita Forum. I linked it. It's in the program summary right now. You can click it and go to it, to that article, and read the comments. There's this guy named Thomas Witt. He's executive director of the Kansas Equality Coalition. He is really turned into one of my local heroes. Watching him in the comment perform is like a ballet. He first writes a very polite letter of record in the comment section. He doesn't flame people. He just gets right to the matter of a guy named Jim Ward. I think that's his name. Let me make sure I'm right. He's a Democrat representing Wichita, and he says that representing Jim Ward, Democrat at Wichita, who opposed the law on voter suppression. The article deals with voter suppression and Secretary of State Chris Kobach, and it's really a hilarious article. It's a good article, don't get me wrong. The hilarious go back and forth. You know, in Wichita, you get crazy people in the comment section because they can write, quote-unquote, anonymous. They just say the most outrageous, stupid, inflammatory things. Take it from a guy who knows how to do that. I mean, I do that routinely to make a point, but I usually base it on some facts. But these people are just crazy in Wichita. And Tom Witt wades into the middle of this mad herd of flamers and writes this incredible. He tracks it down and says that Jim Ward's a liar and that he voted for the voter suppression laws that Chris Kobach brought in. And he brings up the voting record, puts it right on the comment section, and then gains the respect enough of reporter Leffler at the Wichita Eagle to comment on that because he has a voting record. There's Tom. I'm looking at it right now. And Witt, in shorthand, this is something I need to talk to Tom, Mr. Witt, about. He shorthands these stuff about how these votes travel through the legislature before it reaches the governor's desk. And he puts out the exact time and date of the vote, as it's amazing. And then Leffler, John Leffler, reporter, he comments on it about, Thomas, I haven't been able to access the journal for that day to confirm that vote, but I will assume your tally sheet is correct. Leffler wiggles around. It's hard to, I mean, with these politicians, it is. And it's not just Jim Ward, Democrat. My God, they're all that way. Really, they get to wiggling around. But Thomas Witt goes right into there. Here he says, here's his last response that I can see on this comment thread. Dion, Ward voted against the bill on February 25th, but when the Senate sent back the final version on March 29th, he voted in favor. That was the last vote taken to send it to the governor. And he cites the links the bill history to track it. And it's just, thank you so much, Thomas Witt, for correcting the record. That is so inspiring. That was a front-page article, Voter ID Law Criticized at Wichita Forum. There was over 100 people easily. There's a YouTube of it linked at the courtesy of the Occupy Wichita folks who videoed it and put it on YouTube all last night. It was great. CanVote, K-A-N-V-O-T-E, lit up the grassroots and brought out Occupy Wichita, and a bunch of people, a bunch came in. They really just sort of swallowed up the reactionaries there that were in the crowd. And on an open mic session to speak to the legislators. Now, a topic paragraph to speak on a variety of issues ranging from abortion to fluoridated water to police brutality. I think that's interesting. Abortion, fluoridated water did not gain the usual traction in that in this article. And again, this was printed on the front page of the Wichita paper today, I believe, Wednesday. So I'm really impressed with that. And that's sort of your local news. You could go there, and I'm real impressed with that. I'm so happy to report this to you up here in Northeast Kansas and to our Kansas expats, our expatriates out there outside the state of Kansas, that there is some real sustained resistance developing. And you'll hear about it here on Radio Free Kansas if we can keep on the air. If we can keep on the air, we'll do. I'll be happy to report it to you. It's time for the full version of today's Free Speech Radio News. It'll be on for about 29 minutes, and I'll be back with you to give you a little bit more updates on the local prairie fires starting out here in the drought.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, January 9th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the Supreme Court hears a case on how far police can go to test drivers suspected of drunk driving. Privacy advocates say a warrantless blood test is too invasive. In Texas, a 15-year-old's case challenging a school program that requires students to carry an electronic tracking chip draws religious and privacy concerns. In Mexico, small farmers and environmentalists call on the government to block large-scale genetically modified corn. And we'll go to Kurdistan, where hundreds of Syrian refugees are arriving every day and many struggle to get by. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. There's speculation today the White House is considering hosting a climate summit during Obama's second term. An Oregon environmental group told The Guardian it has had encouraging discussions with White House staff on the issue. The speculation comes on the heels of EPA head Lisa Jackson's resignation in late December and a new report out yesterday by NOAA. The National Climatic Data Center says 2012 was the warmest year on record in the contiguous 48 states. The data also indicates extreme weather events such as flooding and droughts are becoming more common. FSRN's James Moore reports from KRUU-FM in Iowa, one of several Midwest states where temperatures were far above normal.
Last year was Iowa's warmest since 1931, the dawn of the Dust Bowl era. And as during the Dust Bowl, much of the Midwest experienced severe rain shortages. Here, the worst drought in 50 years killed trees in cities across the state, and corn yields are expected to be down for the fourth straight year. Low water levels on the Mississippi and other Midwest rivers are creating significant challenges for barges trying to move grain to the Gulf. Iowa State University climatologist Elwin Taylor, who has studied agricultural climates for decades, has cautioned farmers and river shippers to get used to more volatile weather. Taylor believes nighttime temperatures are the key climate threat for farm economies. According to research, when overnight temperatures rise 4 degrees Fahrenheit above normal, grain crop yields are reduced by 15 to 20%. In 2012, 19 states experienced their warmest years since data began being collected in 1895. James Moore, FSRN, Fairfield, Iowa.
A new legislative session begins today in Illinois, and LGBT rights supporters say they intend to reintroduce same-sex marriage legislation before day's end. Lawmakers were unable to garner enough support for the measure during the previous session, which ended yesterday. But before the turnover, the General Assembly was able to pass a law allowing undocumented immigrants to get state driver's licenses. Governor Pat Quinn has praised lawmakers for saving lives on Illinois roads by mandating driver training, eye tests, and insurance for some 250,000 immigrant motorists. But as FSRN's Jay Saper reports, there's concerns about what this will actually mean for undocumented drivers.
This bill, touted as a common-sense traffic safety measure, was met with passionate pushback. Opponents blasted it for condoning illegal entry and inviting fraud. There are also divisions within the ranks of immigration rights groups and nervous immigrants. Claudia Enriquez, an attorney with the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, opposed the legislation based on the experiences of immigrants in other states.
They signed up to get the driving privilege card, and then the next day, for example, ICE showed up on their doorstep.
Supporters say the Illinois law has built-in protections to keep this kind of situation from occurring. The new licenses will not serve as official identification for boarding planes, buying guns, or voting. Jay Saber, FSRN, Chicago.
A judge has struck down part of the New York Police Department's stop-and-frisk policy. Yesterday, for the first time, a federal court ordered the NYPD to halt certain practices within the controversial program. From New York, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo has more.
The part of the NYPD's stop and frisk program in question is called Operation Clean Halls. It aims to prevent trespassing in and around privately owned apartment buildings in high crime areas. Landlords must enroll to take part. U.S. District Judge Shira Sheenlin ruled Tuesday to end the practice. She said in these trespassing cases, it's difficult to pinpoint the line where police encounters become unconstitutional. But, quote, such a line exists, and the NYPD has systematically crossed it. Udi Offer of the New York ACLU says police often arrested friends and family of tenants, and even some tenants themselves, who didn't have identification on them.
Meaning that in the vast majority of cases, there wasn't even suspicion of a crime. And that's a problem, and that's what has to stop.
Stop and frisks technically require suspicion of a crime, but only 12% of the 685,000 stops last year led to arrests. Offer called the judge's ruling a big step towards eventually ending the stop-and-frisk program. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, New York.
The flag of the United Kingdom, the Union Jack, is flying at Belfast City Hall today for the first time since lawmakers decided not to display it permanently. Intense protests have been ongoing since that decision, recalling historic tensions between loyalists and nationalists in Northern Ireland. FSRN's Gloria Comker reports from the UK.
The flag is being flown to mark the birthday of Kate Middleton, the Duchess of Cambridge. But the occasion has not quelled anger of British loyalists in Northern Ireland. In Belfast, hundreds of demonstrators have been protesting daily since early December when the council decided to limit the number of days the Union flag flies at City Hall to 17 per year. The flag will be taken down again this evening. Further demonstrations are planned, including a rally outside the Irish Parliament in Dublin on Saturday. The protests at times violent have resulted in more than 1,000 arrests and dozens of police officers being injured. Gloria Kamkar, FSRN, Southampton.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The state of Missouri argued before the U.S. Supreme Court today that it shouldn't have to get a warrant in order to take a blood sample from someone suspected of driving drunk. But some states and civil liberties groups disagree, saying a possible DUI conviction shouldn't allow a violation of privacy rights. FSRN's Alice Olstein attended this morning's hearing and files this report.
When Tyler McNeely was pulled over by a Missouri state trooper for speeding in 2010, he failed several field sobriety tests and refused twice to take a breathalyzer test. He was then driven to a hospital and had a blood sample taken without his consent and without a warrant. His blood alcohol level was found to be nearly twice the legal limit, but a court order ruled last year that the blood sample evidence could not be used against him because it was obtained unconstitutionally. During Wednesday's arguments, the state of Missouri asked the Supreme Court to overturn that ruling and to legalize all warrantless blood samples for drunk driving arrests. Veteran Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston explained the state's position.
Well, Missouri, supported by the federal government, was relying very heavily upon the argument that because chemically alcohol in the bloodstream dissipates rapidly over time, police don't have the time to go to a judge and get an order to allow them to take a blood sample in order to prosecute the suspect for drunk driving charges. And that was an argument that was based on the premise that time is so precious in a drunk driving situation that the Fourth Amendment requirement for a court order or warrant should never be enforced in a drunk driving case.
Yet several justices took issue with the notion of doing away with warrants entirely whenever there's a delay in obtaining one. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor added that the state has no constitutional right to get the best evidence against someone. Speaking outside the Supreme Court after the arguments, McNeely's attorney Steve Wilson also challenged the state's argument that there was no time to get a warrant in his client's case.
All I can say is the forced blood draw that they did gave a result of, I think it was 0.15. And at the normal dissipation rate, you're going to be above 0.08 from a 0.15 for at least 2.5-3 hours.
And regardless of how long it would have taken to get a warrant, McNeely's other lawyer, Stephen Shapiro, said society's interest in convicting drunk drivers doesn't outweigh the individual's interest in avoiding unreasonable and intrusive searches.
If the court says you never need a warrant before you can put a needle in somebody's arm and take blood for the purposes of then prosecuting that person, what you're going to find is you're going to find states are not going to go through the warrant process. Why should they if they don't have to? And I think that will be a significant loss for personal privacy. I'm hoping the court will not go there.
The Supreme Court ruled back in 1966 that police could take a blood sample without a warrant, only if other emergency circumstances would delay them from getting one, such as transporting crash victims to a hospital. Shapiro pointed out that there was no such extra delays in this case, and that cell phone and internet technology developed since that ruling makes it even quicker for police to obtain a warrant. He also challenged Missouri's argument that natural blood alcohol dissipation is the same as someone flushing drugs down a toilet, saying that intentional destruction of evidence is a different story.
It's not only that the suspect is often the agent of the destruction of the evidence, but that the evidence once destroyed is destroyed totally and immediately. This is a slow and gradual process.
More than 24 states ban police from taking warrantless blood samples. But 32 states and D.C. and Guam are backing Missouri in this case. Shapiro and other privacy advocates express concern that a ruling for Missouri could start a slippery constitutional slope, where other states legalize warrantless blood samples in DUI and other cases. Justice Elena Kagan shared these concerns and wondered during Wednesday's arguments whether states would also want to start taking non-consensual blood samples for underage drinking cases. The court is expected to issue an opinion this spring. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In Texas, a public school district has been allowed to continue to require students to carry locator chips, according to a ruling by a federal judge Tuesday. U.S. District Judge Orlando Garcia dismissed a request by a 15-year-old sophomore to block San Antonio's Northside Independent School District from requiring her to carry a student badge. The student's family had cited religious and privacy reasons. Officials at John Jay Science and Engineering Academy say the use of the electronic devices called radio frequency identification, or RFIDs, is part of a pilot program to ensure safety and increase school attendance. Privacy advocates raise concern about the use of the technology and possible violations of civil liberties. For more, we're joined by Kalia Barnes, Administrative Law Counsel at the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you, Dorian.
This electronic device in the San Antonio School District is part of the ID that students carry with them at school. What exactly is the device and how does it work?
Well, Dorian, an RFID tag contains basically a microchip, and that's programmed with a unique identification number that's used to tag an individual or an object. And the unique identification number can be read by one or more computer databases. And the databases will basically say where the RFID chip has been located.
And in this case, school officials said that that chip was part of the student ID. A couple other details in the ruling, Judge Garcia said that it does not work off campus, only on campus, and then it does not pinpoint the exact location, but tells if a student, for example, is in a certain wing of the school.
Correct. That's how certain technology can work. You can definitely get RFID chips that are more specific, and you can get them with different distance ranges. So in this case, it only monitored students who are on campus, but you can vary the distance that the RFID chip reader can, I guess, basically reach the RFID chip.
According to school officials, the purpose is safety and to improve classroom attendance. The district said it was losing $1.7 million a year from students not being in class during school because the funds are based on attendance. A district official says they are not attempting to track students or regulate their activities. Now, your organization and others have said that the technology should not be used in schools. What are your primary concerns?
Well, we have there are a few unique privacy threats that the use of this technology poses. Number one, as you see with this case, is violation of religious freedoms. There are certain members of the population that it violates their religious beliefs to have an RFID chip to be tracked. When you're also looking at dehumanizing uses, there are certain trackers that are quite specific, and so a student doesn't necessarily, you know, want all of the school officials to know each time she maybe visits the nurse's office or the restroom facilities or the school counselor. But you also want to think about violation of free speech and association. What these trackers can reveal is maybe whether a student has attended a certain political group on campus, and maybe that student doesn't want that information exposed to education authorities.
And in these kinds of programs, who is collecting the data? Who's in control of that data? Who has access to it?
You posed a very good question, and that's another concern with this type of technology. It's not always clear. You know, sometimes it will be the school officials who are on campus, but they may also outsource this technology. And that poses unique questions about who has this data, for how long do they have this data, can this data be linked to other information?
In this specific case in San Antonio, the school did offer to take the tracking chip out of the plaintiff's ID. There are other schools, other districts that have proposed using RFID tracking. Have there been other court challenges by families?
At this time, I'm unaware of other court challenges, but you actually bring up the interesting point about this case. I mean, this school took a right step by removing the RFID chip, but a bigger problem is that there's not enough guidance. There are not enough state laws or policies that regulate the use of this technology. So whereas you have this school district that made this decision to remove the chip, you may have other school districts that decide not to. So there needs to be legislation with concrete policies underscoring that students have the right to opt in to this type of technology, and then there should be other regulations with the use of this technology.
Kalia Barnes is Administrative Law Counsel at the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Dorian.
Photos from Damascus today showed thick snow falling from the sky as local residents described dipping temperatures, and aid organizations warned of difficulty reaching those in need. The World Food Program said it's having a hard time bringing aid to more than 1 million people displaced by the fighting in the country. As the civil war in Syria thunders on, refugees are fleeing the country on a daily basis. Many Syrian Kurds head for the autonomous Kurdistan region of northern Iraq, just across the border. And while many of them choose to stay in the United Nations camp of Domis, others are coming to the cities in the hope of better living conditions and a chance to find work. But life for these urban refugees is an uphill battle, as FSRN's Hermione G reports from the Kurdistan region's capital, Erbil.
It's a rainy winter afternoon, and Amir Harkey and Tom Robinson are driving an overloaded 4x4 through Erbil's rush hour traffic. Co-founders of the Refugee Integration Support and Education Foundation, they're on their way to deliver donations to Syrian refugees living in the city.
That part of town that we're going, there's over 100 families living there. But they're basically scattered around Erbil in different parts of the town. And there's continuous daily.
Every time we're there, we see a new family. And the thing is, a family can be anywhere from 2 to sort of 17. I think 14 or 17 is the biggest family we've seen.
Most of the Syrians in Erbil are Kurds, but they speak a different dialect of Kurdish than the locals, and most lack any kind of social support network here. The Kurdistan government has granted them the right to live and work anywhere in the region, and many of them are squatting in empty houses on the outskirts of town. And with winter setting in, Robinson explains, they're facing very harsh conditions.
There are those that have a decent enough house but are lacking supplies. On the other hand, there are these people that have quite literally nothing. The house is just complete shell, no windows, no doors, kids not wearing shoes when it's cold and it's absolutely pouring with rain. Today we're taking a bunch of clothes, I think there's some bedding in there, and there's a heater in the back too. Yesterday we did a big delivery of family-sized packs of food. So yeah, it's this basic level of support we're trying to provide.
Once winter is over, the foundation, also known as RISE, will offer longer-term support services to help the refugees integrate into the community. But today, it's cold, dark, and wet, and it's challenge enough to make sure people get the essentials. As the RISE truck pulls up on an unpaved, waterlogged street in the Kazdazan neighborhood, it's immediately surrounded by a crowd of men, women, and children.
We're just trying to deliver some clothes and supplies now, but it turns into a real kind of mob scene very fast.
They're basically ripping at the lorries about the side, and grabbing everything. And I went to open the bag to give them the toys, and it was just ripped out.
Hello.
There are currently over 50,000 Syrian refugees in Kurdistan, and many of them choose to stay in the UNHCR camp in Dimiz, according to the region's Bureau for Migration and Displacement. The Kurdistan Regional Government, or KRG, is planning to set up a camp for the 12,000 refugees in Erbil. But Shoker Yassin, director of the Migration Bureau, says the region is desperately short of funds.
The countries that are supposed to help the refugees, they are helping refugees in other countries, in Turkey, in Lebanon, but we haven't got any funds in the KRG. Baghdad isn't sending us any money, even though 90% of the Syrian refugees are in Kurdistan. The UNHCR and other NGOs are working with us, but their ability is limited. Some groups can give tents, some can give food, but this problem won't be solved with just tents and food.
One family in need of help is 27-year-old Salah, his wife, and two children. They came to Erbil 6 months ago, and they're struggling.
As a family, we pretty much need everything. Food is what we constantly require. I work when I can, but it might be 5 days work, 10 days without. The days that I don't work, we can't even afford to buy bread. There's never enough.
They are more fortunate than many and have a small but warm apartment they share with another family. And at least they're safe, Salah says.
It's difficult. But the security situation is good here. I left Syria because I was called up to serve in the army. If I'd gone to the army, I'd have to kill my own people, and I didn't want to do that. If I'd stayed, they might have executed me.
But they're all still hoping to go home, says Salah's uncle, Bozan.
We left Syria because we were worried about our kids, and now they're destroying our country. But in the end, I will go back. The soil of my country is dear to me, and this is not our home. But where else could we go? When the situation gets better, we'll go back.
No one knows when that will be. But as long as the Syrians have to stay in Kurdistan, says Amir Haki, there are many local people willing to help them. It wasn't that long ago that they were refugees themselves.
For me, one of the motives actually was that I remember 1991 when we flew to the mountains because of the old regime in Saddam. I remember the moment that I had no food to eat, no clothes to wear, with bare food. And every time I see them, I remember myself. And that's like the local people, as long as they see them, that they don't have any clothes to put on or any food to eat, then the people are very eager to help.
According to the UN Refugee Agency, hundreds of Syrian refugees continue to arrive in Kurdistan each day. But as long as the donations keep coming in, say Haki and Robinson, they will continue to serve as many of them as possible. Hermione G., FSRN, Erbil, Iraqi Kurdistan.
In Mexico, groups of small farmers and environmentalists are calling on the government to reject permit applications which would open up large swaths of productive agricultural land to commercial production of genetically modified corn. They cite cultural and scientific concerns. FSRN's Shannon Young reports from Oaxaca.
Corn is more than just a staple crop in Mexico. It's a pillar of national identity. This is especially true in the southern state of Oaxaca, where the earliest discovered traces of domesticated corn date back more than 8,000 years. It's also where small farmers have been organizing against the introduction of genetically modified corn for more than a decade.
Iniciar nuevamente el año 2013 para seguir con la defensa del maíz nativo.
Members of indigenous-led organizations committed to preserving Oaxaca's corn biodiversity have declared 2013 the year of resistance and defense of native corn. They're calling on the government of President Enrique Peña Nieto to reject application permits which would open up hundreds of thousands of acres in the northern states of Sinaloa and Tamaulipas to the commercial production of genetically modified varieties patented by Monsanto and Pioneer. Aldo González is with the UNOSJO, an organization active in Oaxaca's rural Sierra Juárez Mountains.
What's most worrisome is that Sinaloa is the country's biggest supplier of corn. That this corn stock would begin circulating around the country creates a risk of even more genetic pollution. For example, there's no labeling requirement for genetically modified corn, nor is there a rule for grinding it down. So if viable seeds start circulating around the country, it poses a serious risk to Mexican native corn.
Genetic pollution resulting from the cross-pollination of transgenic varieties with native corn has been a reality for years in Oaxaca, despite a national moratorium on GM corn cultivation, which was in place at the time and was supposed to protect native seed biodiversity. The pollution was first discovered by scientists from UC Berkeley, and the issue was later followed by researchers in Mexico City. But continued monitoring of the extent of genetic pollution has fallen off. Small farmer Josefina Santiago says members of her organization began noticing deformations in their corn plants in 2001. Samples were sent for testing and came back positive for containing modified genes. Some samples contain genes from three different modified varieties. One of those varieties is Starlink, developed by Aventis AgroScience, which is not approved for human consumption.
They were analyzed in the lab, but since we don't have the economic means to send off samples for expensive testing, we rely more on the visual cues from deformations. We ask farmers to be on the lookout for plants with abnormalities and to get rid of them to minimize the contamination and to help conserve the seeds that we have.
For many small farmers in Oaxaca, education and tapping into generations of corn culture is key to preserving the native seed biodiversity. Fernando Soberanes, a member of an association of rural school teachers, says migration has also had a profound impact on corn biodiversity.
Since there is no government support for small farmers, people are forced to migrate. Many of those who do come back have lost a big part of the culture of corn. So we tried to promote this within the schools. In past years, we've encouraged all of our schools to plant corn within the ground. If there is no land, then at least in pots. And that is done with the participation of the small farmers. Some would say, bring in the technical experts, but why, if the real specialists are the small farmers? It's so parents teach kids what working the land is about.
No date has been set for the decision on the pending permits for large-scale production of genetically modified corn in Sinaloa and Tamaulipas. The paperwork for it was submitted months ago, and the administration of Felipe Calderón put off the decision. However, reforms reduced the required steps for approval, leaving the decision in the hands of Mexico's Secretary of Agriculture. Since the first week of the new administration, small farmers and environmentalists have been openly stating their position, using the phrase, "Sin maíz, no hay país." Without corn, there's no country. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
And before we go, a correction. In our segment on Bradley Manning yesterday, we incorrectly identified a sound clip as reporter Kevin Gostola. The speaker was, in fact, attorney Michael Ratner. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Shauna Ray. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. Our Washington, D.C. intern is James Helmsworth. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
I'm Denny Woods, a backup anchor for Free Speech Radio News. And the days in June are passing very quickly, and we're still many thousands of dollars from achieving a target that will allow us to stay on air. Now, I'm not trying to blow my own trumpet, but I've worked on quite a lot of news programs for a range of broadcasters, from the BBC, including programs like NewsHour and The World Today, to German radio, Dutch radio, France 24, and I've never worked with a group of more professional and dedicated people than the ones I work with at Free Speech Radio News. But to say I actually work with them is an overstatement. We all work from home, and we communicate by Google and telephone. And so if you donate money, it won't be going to fancy overheads or to renovating a new building. It'll be going directly to gathering the news and the things that make FSRN unique, because it is unique. There's no half hour of news you can listen to in the USA that so profoundly and in-depth covers affairs in Washington and also international news. And listening to the program and doing the program is an education in what's going on around the world and in your backyard. And it's something that should stay on air. And so I implore you to donate generously. And if you know someone who can donate generously, please get in touch with us or get in touch with them and help keep the flame burning at this very good news organization, this very credible news organization, this news organization that deserves to stay on air.
With 200 contributing reporters on 6 continents, Free Speech Radio News brings you the news from many corners of the world.
Екатерина Данилова, FSRN, St. Petersburg, Russia.
Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
Ghassan Banoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
Khalid Silmohand, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
Madonna Virola, FSRN, Calapan City, Philippines.
While many newsrooms have closed their bureaus overseas, FSRN's network of reporters living in the communities they cover enables us to bring you international coverage each and every weekday. International grassroots reporting that is indispensable and irreplaceable. Support FSRN and our global coverage by visiting our website, fsrn.org.
That's right. Now, you know, I'll tell you what. The blowtorch here in Northeast Kansas, KKFI.org, does not carry Free Speech Radio News. I'm the only one, as far as I know, in Kansas that carries Free Speech Radio News on a regular basis, and I need your support. It's very, very easy. You really should consider. It's a short $1,000 I need to raise to pay the yearly dues that will keep Radio Free Kansas on the air for a complete year. And it's only recently, in the last, oh, I don't know, what, 6-8 months, I've started 6 and 7 day programming, bringing you some really, really good guests on my weekend shows. And I know that the Secular Sunday is just taking off. Of course, there's the Leroy Show. I really need your help. We need to raise $1,000 by the end of January or we will go off the air. And I'm making this pitch because it's important, and I think you will understand if you'll miss it. Believe me, you'll miss RFK once it goes. I'm going to close with these local news announcements. They're a reminder that tomorrow night in Wichita at the Wichita State University from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Metroplex located at 29th and Oliver. There's going to be another community forum. Now, I told you earlier how big and well-attended the last one was in Wichita just yesterday evening, Tuesday evening. Got front page coverage in the Wichita Eagle, a great article by Dan Leffler. Go to the website for the Eagle. Check out the commentary. especially that of Mr. Thomas Witt. But tomorrow night, there'll be one with Kansas Representative Melody McRae Miller about the extraordinary high rate of African-American, Latinos, Native Americans, and other youth who are being arrested in Kansas. If you compare the numbers, it's 3 and 4 times as higher than white youth in Kansas. That forum begins again at 6 to 8 p.m. at Wichita State University Metroplex, located at 29th and Oliver. And let's not forget, I got an update on Lee Camp's Kick Comedy Theater appearance in Kansas, Missouri at 4010 Pennsylvania Street. That's right on the edge of Westport. The 7 o'clock show Friday night is sold out. You cannot get a ticket. You'll have to walk up to the door. There are about 20 seats left to get a ticket at the 7 p.m. show. And the 10 p.m. is still available. Tickets are still available at leecamp.brownpapertickets.com. Again, that's leecamp.brownpapertickets.com. You can still get in the 10 p.m. show online. I noticed on Facebook that there are people as far away as Wichita going to the Lee Camp Comedy Special there at Kick Comedy Theater, 4010 Pennsylvania in Kansas City, Missouri. Get your tickets now if you want to go to the 10 p.m. show. Also, this Saturday, January 12th at 2 p.m., Occupy Kansas wants me to remind all the Radio Free Kansas listeners that there will be a free movie on the drug war called The House I Live In at Wichita's Murdoch Theater, which is located at 536 North Broadway Street in beautiful Wichita. Again, that's at Wichita's Murdoch Theater. Free afternoon matinee beginning at 2 p.m. this coming Saturday. It's an old-time tradition there, isn't it? Saturday matinee. Well, you used to have to only pay like a quarter, but now it's free, and it's a movie, The War on the Drug Wars, The House I Live In. For more information, contact area code 316-263-1665. And we have one more announcement for this weekend, or, well, actually, Friday, January 18th. I'm happy to announce that the Wichita Now organization of the National Organization of Women is their ticket, their registration for their banquet, the award banquet, is filling up quickly. I got that from Carrie Ann Rinker on her Facebook. Thank you, Carrie. 6 p.m., January 18th, they're going to be a banquet at the Corporate Caterers of Wichita, located at 2949 North Rock Road, Suite 100. Again, that's 2949 North Rock Road, Suite 100. It's the first annual award banquet for the Colleen Kelly Johnston Award, She Made a Difference Award. And it's also celebrating the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Go check it out. Also, now tomorrow, Friday night, I'll have another news night, and there is some great developments. I didn't write down notes today, but Vicki Stengel down there in Wichita, who is sort of coordinating the Great Plains chapter of the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, announced that they've got a location for the Darwin birthday banquet, which is coming up in early February. I'll have all the details for you on that Friday and probably every news night here on Late Night Radio Free Kansas. I hope you enjoyed the show tonight. I would run into the downloads, though, but I really have some things to do. And I want you to know I appreciate your company on these late night shows. I've been in contact with Don Pesky. This January 26th, this get together for beginning farmers in Leonardville, Kansas, is really turning into an event. I want you to know more about it. Again, all this and more on upcoming events in the grassroots of Kansas. Resistance events is what I call it. They may not like that, some of these people sponsoring these, but it is an act of resistance in my books to do this kind of stuff. And I really am looking forward to getting another year going here in Radio Free Kansas. keeping it on the air for a whole year. You can't get beat that for a grand. I mean, that's pretty cheap. I'll be sending out more fundraising things, and I would like you to consider donating to it. It's at a P.O. box in Kansas City, Kansas. I have an auditor, you might say, who has helped me out for many, many years, and he's sort of my auditor. He keeps track of the money. He's the man. I want you to consider it. This is Cindy Cash Dollar playing her instrumental Locust Grove for you. For you people outside of the area that aren't familiar, we have a particular thorny brand of locust trees out here. 6-inch thorns that are poisonous. Sometimes those of us left that are left in Kansas will tell you some stories about running through a locust grove. Good night.